Today on Wings.
Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out?
Way back in 2007, a charming little animated video called The Story of Stuff started opening people's minds to the economy-environment connection. It animated a movement that's still strong in 2025. From the Wings Archive 2011, here's the late Kelly Ramirez Watson with the story of The Story of Stuff.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy.
That's Annie Leonard, the voice of and the force behind The Story of Stuff, a video just under 22 minutes long that has spawned a book, teaching curricula, and other short videos that take a look at why our stuff is not making us healthier or happier and what we can do about it. I'm Kelly Ramirez Watson. I visited the Story of Stuff office in Berkeley, California in October of 2011. While Annie herself was not available for interview, I was able to speak with Allison Cook, the Special Projects Coordinator. She manages film releases and curriculum development and has worked with Annie since shortly before the release of the first film in 2007. Together with clips of several of the videos, Allison and I will tell you the story of The Story of Stuff.
I actually met Annie through a mutual friend of ours who I used to intern for in D.C., Robert Weissman, executive director at Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. I used to be his intern when he was at Essential Action. And so when I moved back out to California, I said, "Hey, Rob, I'm looking for work. Would you be a reference on my resume?" And Rob got right back to me and he was like, "You know, I have this good friend who used to work here with us in DC, and I think the two of you guys would get along really well." And I immediately got an email back from Annie saying, "I'm about to launch this movie. I need just a few hours of help a couple of days a week. Would you be interested?" I said, "Of course." And so I started working with Annie right before she launched the Story of Stuff movie in 2007. And lo and behold, it turned into a full-time job. And here I am 4 years later.
I noticed that most of the team is female. Is this a total accident, or is there some kind of female sensibility about this project?
It is not by design, it is by accident. And Michael has certainly been advocating for a little bit more gender equity for our staffing. But everyone who works here is incredible. It just so happens there are a bunch of incredible women who work here, but Michael is phenomenal, as is Marvin, who is our other intern.
The movies are all very simple. They're not even timed to a clock like for TV or radio production.
The beauty of the internet.
Yeah. They're a certain style of black and white animation and Annie in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks simple, but I know it cannot be simple. So can you tell us a little about how it works behind the scenes?
Of course. So typically we will decide that we want to tell a particular story, oftentimes as much as a year or two in advance. We're just a small little shop over here. There's just five of us. We work with a really broad network of incredible activists, organizers, and researchers all across the country and sometimes even across the globe. Because we want the movies that we make to reinforce the incredible campaign work and advocacy and research that's being done by our friends and partners and allies. And so we usually kind of send out some feelers in terms of who's working on particular issues, what are they working on, what do they think are some of the most important messages for us to communicate to our audience, to our community. So once we get a little bit of a rough concept in place, we work really closely creatively with an organization based here and then also in DC called Free Range Studios. on developing the script and creative concepting. We'll work with them on developing the storyline, who the characters are, and they also do all of the animations over there. Ruben de la Luna is their main animator. He is a wonder human. He does a great job with those. And what we do is oftentimes for each line in the movie, we will read entire books or talk to 7 people. We do an incredible amount of research and then condense it into a 1,300-word script just so that we kind of reverse engineer it. So it seems really light and easy, but in fact, there's actually a lot of legwork and a ton of research and consultation that happens in that research process. And then also there's a very kind of labor-intensive creative process that Annie participates in with the folks over at Free Range to refine some of the storytelling aspects. Once we lock the script, we go to like basically a green room, for lack of a better phrase, and Annie records the script, and then we send those files off to Free Range, and then they get busy animating. The animation process usually lasts about a month and a half or so, but the creative process overall is usually anywhere from 4 to 6 months.
Why was this particular format chosen, and who do you think it appeals to most?
I would say that there is so much that can be communicated with illustrations that you just can't get across in a report, for example. We oftentimes joke that everyone speaks stick figure, that it's a universal language that people can understand the meaning behind what you're saying, and you can tell a more complex story than you can with words alone. And so we can rely on a very kind of simple, straightforward language, and then the illustrations tell a more robust story, if you will. So that's part of why we decided the format that they're done. In terms of who they appeal to most, I think that there are several different demographics who are really excited about the story of Steph. On one level, it's people who have never really thought about this before, and they're hearing about these issues for the first time, and it's a great introductory piece of education. It's a great kind of starting point from where which you can learn a lot more. I think also a number of kind of activists and organizers really like the movies because they're a great introduction, they're a great 101, they're an incredible organizing tool, whether you're meeting with a congressperson or a neighbor or at a local school. And, you know, schools are another big audience who have really latched onto the story of Steph. We've developed a high school curriculum based off of the movie that we made with a really great organization in Seattle called Facing the Future. And then we've also worked with WGBH in Boston to develop a similar content-wise but very different stylistically series of shorts for younger children about where stuff comes from and how it's made, called Loop Scoops. And then also, kind of much to our surprise but in a way that's very exciting, faith communities have also kind of demonstrated a pretty robust interest in the story of stuff. And we worked with an organization in New Jersey called Green Faith to develop a faith curriculum for Christian teens and then also one for Jewish teens. And we're working on trying to pull one together for Muslim teens as well.
I know that the Christian community is not of a piece when it comes to environmental issues. You have the ones that say, God gave us dominion over the earth and we can do whatever we want with it. And others who say we're stewards of God's creation. How do you interface with various groups?
The reality is that we, on some level, just supply the content. One of the things that's great about the story of Steph is that we have a really expansive and diverse network of people that we work with. And so in terms of navigating the many nuances and diversities of the Christian community, which is expansive, and there are so many different approaches to that type of faith practice, that we really rely pretty heavily on Green Faith and other allies in the faith community to help us kind of navigate those waters. And we are not experts. We are not necessarily even part of that community. And so we rely and lean heavily on these ambassadors to move forward that work.
Any plans to reach out beyond the Abrahamic faiths to pagans, Buddhists, Hindus, etc.?
Certainly, we've gotten several requests for a pagan version, and we've also gotten a number of requests for kind of a more kind of generally spiritual version that kind of includes an kind of interdenominational approach, because there's one of the things that, you know, had never occurred to me before I started doing this work, is that actually there's a huge amount of overlap between kind of this core principles of sustainability and also the major spiritual faiths and traditions, you know, stewardship of the earth and taking care of your neighbor and living within your means. All of those core pieces are reflected so beautifully in both of those traditions.
Have you gotten any idea how many teachers, even just in the United States, are incorporating the story of stuff into their curricula?
In terms of how many people are actually using it, I don't have great numbers. But the curriculum is available for free to download on our website at storyofstuff.org. And last I checked with the folks at Facing the Future, over 20,000 people had downloaded the full curriculum. And so a considerably larger percentage had downloaded just one or two units. It's a multi-week, multi-unit curriculum. And so you can choose to just use a piece or you can choose to use the whole thing. But over 21,000 people had downloaded the whole thing, which for us is really exciting.
Are you getting any feedback from teachers?
We have been getting some feedback from teachers. We're hoping to continue to develop that. I think that one of the reasons that the story of stuff has been so popular in high schools and in schools in general is when we first released the movie 4 years ago, there was not an overwhelming amount of kind of really well-done sustainability education that worked well for school populations, I think. And it really kind of filled that void, and we've gotten really positive feedback from teachers. And it's certainly created some controversy in some communities, but that by and large, it's been a very positive reception.
Are you doing anything in Spanish or Chinese or other languages?
All of our movies are available to translate. We rely on an incredible network of international and local volunteers to translate all of our films. The story of stuff, I believe, has been translated into over 20 languages. And then all of our successive movies, the story of bottled water, story of electronics, and what have you, a number of them have also been translated.
How is the story of stuff being received internationally?
We made the story of stuff particularly for a U.S. audience. With the successive movies as well, they've been pretty U.S. focused. But the reality is that the message has really resonated, and last I checked, about 40% of our audience is actually international, 40% of our community.
What do you think most drives the decision as to what you're going to do next? Is it the headlines? Is it a particular group that really wants to do it?
There are tons of different things that influence our decision-making on what kind of stories we're going to be telling. But I would say that one of the driving factors is that we are deeply committed to transforming our systems of production and consumption to make them sustainable so that they serve people and the planet.
Extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at U.S. rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one.
From the Wings Archive 2011, the story of the story of stuff.
The story of stuff movies that we call season one, the story of stuff, the story of bottled water, electronics, cosmetics. Those movies were made on some level to take pieces from the story of stuff to give an example from people's day-to-day life, shampoo, a laptop computer, those kinds of things, and try and delve that conversation a little bit deeper into the ideas behind it. So manufactured demand, planned obsolescence, those kind of repeating themes that are around us on a day-to-day that once you become aware of it, it becomes easier to shift. And also, as someone who's worked in these issues for so long. Some of it is also kind of bringing Annie's friends on board to be able to help share the platform with them. But I think we've transitioned a bit in the last year or so to try and tell the stories of what we're calling season two. And so those are the stories behind the stories. So the things that are standing in the way of us making the kinds of changes that we really want. So if we really want clean, healthy, safe stuff, what are the things that are standing in the way of that? The first film that we made in season two was the story of Citizens United versus FEC, which is the Supreme Court case ruling that allowed for unlimited corporate spending in elections.
Now, if their main objective is to maximize profit, do you think corporations are content to follow the rules that keep them in check? No, of course not. They want to write those rules. But who is supposed to write the rules in a democracy? People. That's why one of the corporation's key strategies for sneaking into our democracy is saying that they should have the same First Amendment rights as real live people. And that's exactly how they won the 2010 Supreme Court case known as Citizens United versus FEC. In that case, five members of the Supreme Court decided that it's unconstitutional to put any limits on how much money corporations can spend influencing elections. Why? They said these limits violate the First Amendment guaranteeing free speech. Now, obviously, our founding fathers who wrote the First Amendment were trying to protect the free speech of people. But this decision rides on the crazy argument that corporations should be treated the same as people and get the same rights that real people get. This means corporations can spend as much as they want, whenever they want, to intimidate or crush candidates running on a platform against their interests and support candidates who will do what they ask. It's great news for corporations wanting to handpick the lawmakers whose job it is to keep them in check.
No matter what issue we work on, one of the things that's standing in the way of us winning is overwhelming corporate influence in our democratic process. And so we've really got to get that one figured out if we ever want to win on the things that we care about. And so we felt like that was a really important story to tell. Our next movie, which is coming out November 8th, is called The Story of Broke, Why There Is Still Plenty of Money to Build a Better Future.
So why is there always enough money for the dinosaur economy, from big oil to bailouts for big banks? But when it comes to building a better future, we're supposedly broke. Maybe it's because these guys know how to ask for it. Their lobbyists and giant campaign contributions let our government know what they want and what they'll do if they don't get it.
And that one actually is focused specifically on subsidies, but also trying to kind of explode this idea that we're broke. And oftentimes, anytime someone has a good idea, whether it's, you know, clean energy or good schools or better jobs, the response is all too often, oh, that's a lovely idea, but there's no money for that. And the reality is that we live in the United States and there is money. And it's our money, first of all. It's our taxpayer money. And there are a couple things standing in the way of us building the kind of healthy, clean future that we want. And that's that we're not taxing everybody fairly. And that we're subsidizing all of these nasty corporations and nasty industries that are basically just funding the dinosaur economy, whether it's fossil fuels or nuclear or things that have proven again and again to not bring us any closer to the kind of world that we want to live in. And so this upcoming movie is basically saying we can build a healthy, clean, just future. And some of what that's going to take is us rediverting those funds towards good schools and good jobs and healthy food systems and green energy.
Let me play devil's advocate here. I think the reason that we have all the problems with stuff that are outlined in that first movie is because we have money and the need and greed for it. And the desire to make money makes people create planned obsolescence, perceived obsolescence. They dump toxics in our cosmetics and in our food. I think the answer is not rearranging the money, but abolishing it altogether. Have you all ever thought of that?
I have heard that thought. That thought has been introduced to me. I think that there is a lot to be said for thinking systemically and trying to address the problem in a way that really gets to the core root issues. And I think that greed is a huge part of that. And so figuring out how we can design our system in a way that's more equitable and more just and more sustainable is critical. I think that whatever approach you take, there are challenges. And I think that there are challenges to trying to design a system without money. I think that there are also challenges in terms of trying to work within the system as it is. And I think that as we move forward in really trying to advocate for the healthy, clean, just future that we want, we're going to have to think about our relationship to money and think about our relationship to the economy and think about how we can re-engineer those systems to work better for a much larger number of people.
Perhaps the biggest issue that was brought out in the original Story of Stuff movie is the environmental limits that we have on making things. We've got people in the world who definitely need more things, without a doubt, but that's a distribution problem. In the aggregate, we keep making things, and we're running up against this environmental limit, especially with 7 billion people on the planet. What if the sustainability comes from making less stuff in the aggregate and making stuff that is more durable? How do you do that and still keep up with people needing jobs and needing to make money so that they can get around in the world, when in fact they need less stuff? They need more leisure time, they need more time with their families, etc., and less so-called productivity. What if that's the way the world becomes more sustainable? How do you tell people that?
Well, I think that there are a number of challenges that you've outlined that we're facing. And the reality is, in some ways, is that we need to figure out a better way to do things because we are running up against those limits. We're running up against ecological limits. We're running up against social limitations that Annie oftentimes says, you know, the challenge that we face is we're trashing people, we're trashing the planet, and we're not even having any fun.
So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before, but polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted. So we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us you suck. So you got to go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you got to go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought. So you come home and you're more tired. So you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again. And we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop.
We are in a state of ecological chaos. We're in a state of social chaos. We're being terrible to everyone. And it's not even any fun. And it would be one thing if we were using up all the world's resources and like everybody was having a really good time. You know, then we may want to try and like figure out how to make the party last a little bit longer. But people aren't healthy and they don't have leisure time and they don't like their work or they aren't working. And so I think that some of that is kind of trying to figure out the things that we measure. And so a really interesting economist that we've worked with some at Earth Economics says, you know, we pay attention to what we measure. And in the United States, we measure the GDP. And the GDP is actually a really messy number because it's basically just like you take all of the things that happen and then you add them all up. And so, for, you know, example, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was good for the GDP. And if someone gets cancer, it's good for the GDP. And if someone gets in a car accident, it's good for the GDP. And if we're looking at the things that we measure in terms of what I think is important in a society, in a country, in a place, those aren't the things that I want to say, oh, those things indicate that we're doing really well here. Those, to me, those are sad things. Those are things that are doing harm to people, that are doing harm to the environment. And those should be counted negatively towards our well-being as a community. And so I think that there's some really interesting work being done in terms of trying to come up with alternative progress indicators, if you will. It's called the Unhappy Planet Index. Looking specifically at the kind of the rates at which we consume and the way in which that relates to our happiness as a country. Happiness studies in general, it's a very new but very interesting science. They've ranked the amount of consumption and the rates of happiness, and that suggests, as many of us are already well aware, that the more you consume does not necessarily mean that you are happier, and that in the United States were actually pretty bad at converting amount of materials consumed and translating that into happiness.
I love my Pantene Pro-V. Of the dozen or so personal care products that I use every day, it's the one I can't live without. Says it gives my dull hair the ultimate cool shine. How does it do that? I was wondering that while I was lathering it in my hair one day, so I read the ingredients right here. Sodium lauryl sulfate, tetrasodium EDTA, methyl isothiazolinone. What is this stuff? I took this list to some scientists who know how to read it. Turns out my Pantene contains a chemical linked to cancer. And lots of other products in my bathroom, from sunscreen to lipstick and even baby shampoo, also contain chemicals linked to cancer or other problems like learning disabilities, asthma, and even damaged sperm. Like most parents, I try to keep my family safe. But now I find out my bathroom is a minefield of toxins? What are we supposed to do?
The story of cosmetics had a tie-in somehow to the Safe Cosmetics Act. Could you describe a little more about that?
We worked with a really great coalition on that, the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, and they've been working really hard to get this Safe Cosmetics bill passed. And in the United States right now, no one really regulates what's in our personal care products. And so right now in the United States, so many of the things that we put on our bodies every day are filled with toxic chemicals, with neurotoxins, with known carcinogens. Those are things that we know to cause cancer. There's an industry front group that claims that it's regulating these products, but we're using them every day and exposing ourselves to all of these chemicals that we know are toxic. And so the Safe Cosmetics Act is really about trying to get legislation on the books that would can regulate that industry and regulate those products to make sure that when we're washing someone's hair or putting lotion on in the morning, that we're not killing ourselves a little bit by a little bit every day.
Have you heard from the Occupy Wall Street movement? Are you going to do anything with them?
Well, we've been following them very closely here in the office. I think all of us are quite excited by the energy behind that right now. It's people who are getting out there and putting their foot down, and just to see particularly so much energy with young people is very exciting. And we actually, in part inspired by and in part in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street folks, our newest teaser for The Story of Broke makes a ton of references to the Occupy Wall Street movement and the exciting work that they're doing there. You know, there are people standing, little stick figures with 99% signs, and it will be exciting to see what comes of this, and the energy there is pretty thrilling.
That was Allison Cook, Special Projects Coordinator for the Story of Stuff Project. The project website is storyofstuff.org.
It's a really great kind of multimedia node for all of these different issues.
Thanks to the Story of Stuff Project for permission to include audio clips in this interview. For Wings, I'm Kelly Romaris Watson in Berkeley, California.
You can catch up with the latest works of this movement at storyofstuff.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings Series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.